You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after recent mass shootings in Dayton, Ohio, and three cities in Texas, we'll look at new calls to end gun violence, including ending open carry at some major retailers. First, think back to 10 years ago this month. In September of 2009, the Great Recession had been declared officially over, but it didn't feel like it for many Americans. Unemployment was still going up, getting ready to cross the 10% mark for the first time in a quarter century. And housing foreclosures were still on the rise, with 2009 seeing a record 2.9 million houses foreclosed. According to an estimate from the Federal Reserve, last year the crisis ultimately cost each American an average of $70,000 in lifetime income. Our next guest says the economic impact of the Great Recession was huge, but he says we should also pay attention to the long-term political fallout. Gotham Mukunda joins us now as part of a new series on the impact of the Great Recession. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Business School and the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. Gotham, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Do you think we've paid enough attention in the last 10 years or so to the political impact of the Great Recession?
Not even close. I think that we have allowed it to sort of fade in our memories as the stock market bounces up, and we forget just how much pain so many Americans are still feeling. And in that forgetting, we don't see just how much of what's happening in politics today, including things like Trump and Brexit, are probably a direct consequence of that enormous economic disaster.
In a piece you wrote for the Harvard Business Review, you said a fundamental turning point was the federal government bailout of big financial firms. What did you see in how the public reacted to the way that all played out?
So I think there was rage in the public, and I emphasize, and I used to say this to my colleagues at the business school. I'm at the Kennedy School now, but when I was at the business school, if you are not angry, you are not paying attention. And that I think is a pretty profound statement of the extent to which the American financial and intellectual and academic elite can be kind of detached from the way the financial crisis both affected most Americans and appeared to them. At the end of the day, the story of what happened to the financial crisis is, I think, as it's perceived in much of the public, and I believe that this perception is largely accurate, is pretty simple. A relatively small number of American financiers engaged in behaviors that were reckless and borderline criminal and were predatory. The consequence of their actions was the near destruction of the global economy. And the way the United States government chose to punish them for this series of actions was to give them an enormous amount of money. If you were an American whose taxes were going towards that and who was also a victim of the financial manipulations that had generated those profits in the first place and then found the equity in your house wiped out by the housing price crash that as a consequence of the Great Recession, or also just was laid off because of it, how exactly would you feel when you find out that the U.S. government seems to prioritize helping the people who caused it over the people who are the victims of it? That anger is both, in my mind, entirely justifiable and still lasts to this present day.
And you write that there is debate over whether those bailouts were the right move and the way they were handled was the right move. But in a sense, as far as the public reaction, it doesn't matter if it was the right move. There is this issue of the perception of fairness and lack of same.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's exactly what I said. I believe it's true. So I don't want to fail to give Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner and everybody involved the credit that they deserve. And that credit is real. They kept us out of the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario was a rerun of the Great Depression. So you should, so it is good that you did not get us, that you managed to stop that from happening. Where we should sort of limit our praise is I think they managed to get us into the second worst case scenario. One where, okay, we didn't have the Great Depression, but the fundamental unfairness of American society was exaggerated by our response instead of taking this as an opportunity to fix the problems that caused the crisis in the first place.
Talking to Gotham Mukunda with Harvard's Kennedy School, author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter, looking at the political impact of the Great Recession. He says we should be paying more attention to how that has shaped our modern political landscape. Well, both parties were involved in different stages of the bailout. And do you think that people came to distrust both of them because of that fallout?
They did. There's no question that both parties were supported by the financial sector. Both parties participated in deregulation. It's fair to say that there was more opposition to it in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party, where there was essentially none. But the Democrats who were opposed to deregulation of the financial sector lost the election. They weren't in power. They were voices in the wilderness. And so I think people did lose trust in both parties. And more than that, I think they lost trust in the system, because what they saw, it might be, is a, you know, a profound pathology of modern American life. And it's not just limited to the financial crisis. It's just worst there, is the complete impunity of American elites. That essentially, if you reach a certain level in American society, you live a life free of consequences. So if you're a banker who managed to help destroy the world economy, and you're the CEO of one of these banks, and the U.S. government essentially bails you out, you keep your job as CEO. This is kind of astonishing. None of these people were forced out. Okay, but if you are – it's not just the economy. If you are a general in Iraq or Afghanistan who completely mismanages the war – you don't face any consequences there either. People, there was an old, it was a line in the army that a private faces more penalties for losing a rifle than a general does for losing a war. So it is not this problem, this crisis of elite impunity is not limited to the financial crisis. It's just worst there because that's where the stakes are. Because the stakes are so gargantuan.
Did that turn people, many people in many countries, toward a different sort of politician, one that could be seen as outside that system?
Absolutely. So we know historically that financial crises are followed pretty regularly by movements towards populist movements and sort of populist outrage. That happens all over the world, and that's a constant. That's something you should expect. And so in 1929, you saw a populist movement. You saw when the Great Depression happened. 4 years later, you saw Franklin Roosevelt elected on what's an unquestionably populist platform. If you ever want a shock, you should read what Franklin Roosevelt said in his first inaugural address. It is far more radical and far more harsh towards sort of elites, business elites, than anything Bernie Sanders has ever said in his entire life. Franklin Roosevelt talked about malefactors of great wealth. They were the problem in the United States. That's sort of the sort of language he used. And that was the rebellion we saw. But Franklin Roosevelt took advantage of that and took advantage of his complete control of the American political system, where the Republican Party had essentially been devastated by the response to the Great Depression, to create the New Deal so that the American public saw their government work that was on their side, was working on their behalf to meaningfully improve their lives. If you were in rural areas, you got electricity because of the New Deal. That's not a small thing. If you were retired, you got Social Security because of the New Deal. That's not a small thing. So they saw that the government was on their side when they voted for someone who campaigned against the elites who had destroyed the economy, even though Franklin Roosevelt, a Harvard-educated aristocrat, was as elite as a person as it's possible to imagine. So you do see this turn to outsiders, people who want to overturn the system, because your perception after a crisis of this magnitude is that the system is fundamentally corrupt. And again, that perception's not wrong. What we see here is that the sort of historical irony of our reaction to the financial crisis is that the outsiders who took power were far more sympathetic to the people who caused the crisis than the people they replaced.
Talk about how that's played out. You write about that with President Trump definitely running that anti-elite platform. And then what did you see happen?
So what we saw was President Trump during his campaign, if you asked American voters, who did they perceive as more moderate, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? They picked Donald Trump. And they picked him because during the campaign, he talked about doing things like raising taxes on the wealthy, punishing Goldman Sachs. He said that he would be tougher on them than anyone else, than Hillary Clinton ever would be, and than anyone else would be, because supposedly he understood them. We can wonder whether he understood them, but it is unquestionable that in office, he has been far better for them than any other president could possibly have been, from lowering taxes massively on them to tax preferences to right now, Donald Trump's appointees to the Federal Reserve are pushing to undo many of the protections that we put on the financial system after the crisis to stop it from happening again. So they are increasing the risk of the system at the behest of the big banks.
We're talking to Gautam Mukunda, research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. We're looking at the long-term political impacts of the Great Recession. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looking back, did the recession change the way you thought about politics and who you voted for? Did you join or were you sympathetic with the Occupy movement or the Tea Party in part because of the bailout of the financial institutions? What did you think of those bailouts and supports for big Wall Street money companies, insurance companies at the center of the crash? Did it make you angry at one or both parties? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sorry, the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the political impact of the Great Recession. Gotham Mukunda is with us from the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see the Great Recession, the economic collapse, the bailouts of the big financial institutions as a turning point in your view of politics and the way you thought about political leaders, who you voted for? Did it make you an activist in one way or another? What did you think about those bailouts and the way the government handled them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Lucy is with us now in Madison. Lucy, hi.
Hi. Basically, I understand that the banks had to be bailed out in order to prevent depression. But, I mean, the question is, why didn't those bankers go to jail?
Lucy, thanks a lot for the call. Gotham, I've seen this a similar analysis. Even if the bailout was needed, it didn't have to happen in the way that it did, and there could have been more consequences attached, whether it was jail or other consequences.
Yeah, so there are two explanations for that. One is a simple one, and the other one is the bad one. The simple one is these guys didn't go to jail because most of the worst things they did wasn't against the law. Now, the reason for that, you could say, is because the laws were written only after consultation with the bankers in the first place, right? So, of course, they weren't against the law. If you get to write the laws, you get to say what isn't legal. The bigger question is the power of the sector became so great that essentially the Justice Department became afraid to prosecute. And you actually had a statement by the Attorney General where he said, we are afraid to go after these banks because we're afraid of the systemic effects that prosecuting them would have. Essentially, he was afraid that he would cause a crisis if he went after them. So you had this sense that companies that were too big to fail were also too big to jail. And I would say that is a pretty again, this is the sense of elite impunity. Well, because you're this important, you're in some way sense above the law. Well, I wish we could have said that we could have found more prosecutions, and I suspect that a more aggressive and much better resourced Justice Department could have found them. It is striking, by the way, the extent to which the Justice Department has just lost interest in prosecuting white-collar crime. But the better thing to do is to change the laws in such a way as to make sure that this can't happen again.
Well, you also write – thanks for that call, Lucy. You wrote in your piece, Gotham, I think that when auto companies were bailed out, the government weighed in on who ran those companies in some ways. That didn't seem to happen with Wall Street.
Yeah, it's really striking. I mean, Simon Johnson at MIT talked about it as a quiet coup. He said if this happens anywhere else in the world, you'd say what had happened essentially was the government had virtually been overthrown by its financial elites because they got the deal essentially on the terms that they wanted. And this is just remarkable. When the IMF helps to bail out a country in a financial crisis, it insists that the leaders of the financial institutions involved be forced to step down. And the United States government did not do that. There was this sense that somehow these financial companies should be treated differently, that they were better. But in fact, I mean, look, at the end of the day, wealth is not created on Wall Street. The financial sector is an enabler of the creation of wealth, and it's critically important. You cannot have a functioning economy without a financial sector. But wealth isn't created by moving numbers around in a spreadsheet. It's created by people at Boeing or Google or Microsoft or Ford or General Motors, people in those sorts of companies who are actually doing things that generate value for their customers and for everyone else involved as well. The central problem we have at the end of the day is that the American economy revolves around the financial sector instead of the financial sector being the helper for the rest of the economy. The tail is wagging the dog. And when we change that, we'll know we've solved the problem.
Let's go back to our callers. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, I was going to ask a wonderful discussion and a wonderful guest. My question for your guest is, FDR used Joe Kennedy to set up the investment banking system that was undone by Bill Clinton as he tried to become a new Democrat and court Wall Street into the party. How do we prevent good things going awry as people try to get elected? And two, did the Supreme Court really throw a wrench into the whole thing with their using of money as free speech, and corporations should be considered also having free speech as prevent the political process from truly working?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Lots to work with there, Gotham. Let's start with that second point, the influence of political contributions, money as free speech, as Charlie says, on these kind of decisions.
Charlie, thanks for your kind words. I really appreciate it. So I don't think the Supreme Court made the problem any easier to solve. It made the problem worse. But the problem was already so bad that the sort of increasing of making the problem worse is sort of, you know, you're already dying. You can't get more than dead. Right. The way I would think about it is the problem is we think about campaign finance donations matter. They absolutely matter. But that's too easy. It's not a case of politicians being bribed. It's more a case of the fact that these people are so wealthy and so powerful that there's a thing in human beings that we just kind of assume that people who are rich and powerful must be right. I can't tell you how often you hear that, you know, this person's a billionaire, so they must know what they're doing. They must be smart. Well, I grew up in Maryland. I'm a Washington Redskins fan. I watched what Jan Snyder did to the Redskins. So I promise you I know that billionaires are not necessarily that smart. But beyond that, there's just the central issue is less the sort of campaign finance, although that's really important. I don't want to say that's not important. That matters a lot. We should do a lot to cut back on that. The central issue is that this sort of small sector of the economy is so disproportionately powerful that people defer to it whether or not it spends the money. And in fact, people go to work for it. So Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury who managed all this stuff, where did he go after he stepped down from Secretary of the Treasury? He went to an investment bank. That's where he's working now. And, you know, did that influence him consciously? No, I have no doubt that he's a completely honest person. I'm not being ironic. I have no doubt in his honesty. But subconsciously, do you think any human being could not be affected by the prospect of making tens of millions of dollars next year if they just were a little bit more sympathetic to the people they were supposed to regulate?
We are talking to Gotham Mukunda from Harvard's Kennedy School, author of Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter, looking at the long-term impact of the Great Recession on American politics. Back to your calls. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I remember the crash very, very vividly, and it never bottomed out, and it never did come back. And God, I got to catch my breath. We don't. This isn't capitalism. We live in corporate imperialism, and they've just, the small business is dead and gone for the most part. If you got a small business, maybe you got some cash flow, but for the most part, it's dead and gone.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. Gotham, in Eric's voice, I hear a lack of faith. I don't know if it was a loss of faith you ever had it, but a lack of faith in the system, and that was pretty widespread, right?
It is widespread. And I mean, I'd say my faith in the system is shaken. I've been very lucky in my life, and I have nothing to complain about in terms of where I've been and where I've ended up. And my faith in the system is shaken because I believed that the United States was fundamentally, at the end of the day, it was a just society and it would do the right thing. And then I watched this happen, and it was just horrifying. Right. I mean, it was bad enough. The Iraq War was, you know, there was like one thing after another. And then this was kind of the capstone of all of that. And so your faith in the system should be shaken. If it's not shaken, I mean, what type of a system are you envisioned that shouldn't be one that does this? The counterpoint, though, that I'd say is the larger process that we're talking about, this transformation of the economy into one that's all about finance and banking, is called financialization. And it happens to almost every developed economy. You can go back to Venice in the 1500s and see financialization happening. You can see it in Great Britain in the 19th century and the 20th century. There is exactly one example of a highly financialized economy that steps back from the brink and reforms itself into a much healthier one. So the fact that there's only one should worry us, but what should make us feel hopeful is that one is the United States. We did it. During and after the Great Depression, we created a set of rules and regulations that brought the financial sector back into its proper balance with the rest of the economy and created, you know, a middle class like none the world had ever seen before. If we did it once, we are perfectly capable of doing it again. And that's what we should be trying for.
That's one response. Another response out there is that real misbehavior by elites fuels conspiracy theories, extremist politics that have always bubbled under the surface and gives them new energy. Do you worry about that as the alternative if those changes aren't made?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, even if the changes are made, that will happen. The suffering caused by the crisis is real, and people turn to conspiracy theories naturally in that context. But they'll do so much more so if they don't believe that the system is on their side. Right. If you have to have some sort of an explanation why the world's sort of oldest, richest and most stable democracy is somehow not on the side of the people who cast the votes. And that's certainly how it appears to most Americans. So, yeah, I mean, the fundamental health of the American political system is at risk. And it's not just at risk because of Donald Trump. Trump is as much a symptom as he is a cause of this crisis. It is at risk because if Americans stop believing that the system will deliver for them, then they will stop participating in it and they will turn to something else. We need to fix the system, not because it's economically good, although it would be economically good. We'd all be better off for it. We need to fix the system because the survival of our of a democratic society depends on it. When Barack Obama gave a speech to the CEOs of the major Wall Street banks, he said to them, "I am the only thing standing between you and pitchforks." I think that was true in a lot of senses. I used to say to my colleagues, you guys don't understand how things are, what things are like out there. If Obama had said during his inaugural address, you know, my reform, financial reform plan is to hang investment bankers from lampposts in Manhattan, a big chunk of the country would have said, let's give it a try. I'm not saying that's a good thing. We don't want that kind of attitude. We don't want pitchforks. But the rage was real. What I have to say is that we need to tell people that, you know, you should we understand why you feel angry, but don't turn against the system because the system, even if it failed then, is going to fix itself. It's going to end up, it's going to make things right.
Gautam, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Gautam Mukunda, research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of the book Indispensable: When Leaders Really Matter. He joins us today for a look at the long-term political impact of the Great Recession. He says we're still feeling it today.